half buried in the slope, with only my legs exposed to the storm. I dug automatically, while my mind wandered through tortured arguments and asked unanswerable questions. And then I stopped digging and lay still, thinking about the night. Then I dug again. Every few minutes I would shake myself from a mess of thoughts and return to digging, only to find I had drifted off again a few minutes later. It took a long time to complete the cave. It was a weird night. It felt strange to think so coldly about what had happened, as if I were distancing myself from the events. Occasionally, I wondered whether Joe was still alive. I had no idea what he had fallen over. I knew how close we had come to the bottom of the mountain, so it seemed reasonable to hope that he might survive a short fall to the glacier, could even now be digging a snow cave himself. Something made me think this wasn't the case, and I couldn't evade the urgent feeling that he must be dead or dying. I sensed that something awful was hidden in the powder avalanches, swirling madly through the black night below my snow cave. When the cave was finished, I struggled into my sleeping bag and blocked the entrance with my rucksack. The wind and the avalanches rushing across the roof could not be heard, and I lay in the silent darkness, trying to sleep. Plagued with endless thoughts which turned madly upon themselves in vicious circles, sleep was impossible. I tried to get my mind to settle by looking back on what I had done and thinking it all through. After a while I stopped, having succeeded only in recalling the facts, and they were so starkly real that I could draw no conclusions from them. I wanted to question what I had done. It seemed necessary to prosecute myself and to prove that I had been wrong. The result was worse than the vicious circles which had made me think it through. I argued that I was satisfied with myself. I was actually pleased that I'd been strong enough to cut the rope. There had been nothing else left to me, and so I had gone ahead with it. I had done it, and done it well. Shit, that takes undoing. A lot of people would have died before getting it together to do that. I was still alive because I had held everything together right up to the last moment. It had been executed calmly. I had even carefully stopped to check that the rope wasn't going to tangle and pull me down. So that's why I feel so damned confused. I should feel guilty. I don't. I did right. But what of Joe? Eventually I dozed and spent a few troubled hours lost in sleep between waking hours of thinking. Thinking blind in a dark, storm-swept cave. Thinking because my mind refused to sleep, or because I was so pumped up on strain and fear and dread. Thinking, Joe's dead, I know he's dead, in a monotonous litany. And then not thinking of him as Joe anymore. Only the weight gone off from my waist, so suddenly and violently that I couldn't fully grasp it all. As the night lengthened, I sank into a dazed confusion, and Joe faded from memory. It was thirst that took his place, and with each awakening I craved water until it governed my every thought. My tongue felt dry and swollen. It stuck to my palate, and no amount of snow crammed into my mouth could kill the thirst. It was nearly 24 hours since I had taken a drink. In that time, I should have had at least 1.5 liters of fluid to make up for the dehydration caused by the altitude. I smelt the water in the snow around me, and it maddened me. I dozed into exhausted stupors, only to wake abruptly to an insistent craving for liquid. It gradually lightened. I saw axe marks on the roof, and the night was over. With the coming of day, I thought of what I must do. I knew I wouldn't succeed. It wasn't right for me to succeed. I had thought it all through. This was what must happen to me now. I was no longer afraid, and the dread in the night had gone with the dawn. I knew I would attempt it, and I knew it would kill me, but I was going to go through with it. There would be some dignity left to me, at least. I had to try my best. It wouldn't be enough, but I would try. addressed like a priest before Mass, with solemn, careful ceremony. I felt in no hurry to start down and was certain it would be my last day. Filled with a sense of condemnation, I prepared for the day in such a way that it felt as if I were part of an ancient universal ritual, a long-planned ritual which had been born during the dark, thought-racked hours behind me. I fastened the last strap of my crampons onto my boot, and then stared silently at my gloved hands. The careful preparation had calmed me. My fear had gone, and I was quiet. I felt cold and hard. The night had cleaned me out, purging the guilt and the pain. The loneliness since the cutting had also gone. The thirst had eased. I was as ready as I would ever be. I smashed the roof of the cave with my axe and stood up into the blinding glare of a perfect day. No avalanches, and no wind. Silent ice mountains gleamed white around me, and the glacier curved gently westwards to the black moraines above base camp. I felt watched. Something in the crescent of summits and ridges looked down on me and waited. I stepped from the wreckage of the cave and started to climb down. I was about to die. I knew it. And they knew it.
7. Shadows in the ice. I lolled on the rope, scarcely able to hold my head up. An awful weariness washed through me, and with it a fervent hope that this endless hanging would soon be over. There was no need for the torture. I wanted with all my heart for it to finish. The rope jolted down a few inches. "How long will you be, Simon?" I thought. "How long before you join me?" It would be soon. I could feel the rope tremble again, wire tight. It told me the truth as well as any phone call. So, it ends here. Pity. I hope somebody finds us and knows we climbed the west face. I don't want to disappear without trace. They'd never know we did it. The wind swung me in a gentle circle. I looked at the crevasse beneath me, waiting for me. It was big. 20 feet wide at least. I guessed that I was hanging 50 feet above it. It stretched along the base of the ice cliff. Below me it was covered with a roof of snow, but to the right it opened out and a dark space yawned there. Bottomless, I thought idly. No, they're never bottomless. I wonder how deep I'll go. To the bottom? To the water at the bottom? God, I hope not. Another jerk. Above me the rope soared through the cliff edge, dislodging chunks of crusty ice. I stared at it stretching into the darkness above. Cold had long since won its battle. There was no feeling in my arms and legs. Everything slowed and softened. Thoughts became idle questions, never answered. I accepted that I was to die. There was no alternative. It caused me no dreadful fear. I was numb with cold and felt no pain, so senselessly cold that I craved sleep and cared nothing for the consequences. It would be a dreamless sleep. Reality had become a nightmare, and sleep beckoned insistently, a black hole calling me, pain-free, lost in time, like death. My torch beam died. The cold had killed the batteries. I saw stars in a dark gap above me, stars or lights in my head. The storm was over. The stars were good to see. I was glad to see them again, old friends come back. They seemed far away, further than I'd ever seen them before. And bright. You'd think them gemstones hanging there, floating in the air above. Some moved, little winking moves, on and off, floating the brightest sparks of light down to me. Then what I had waited for pounced on me. The stars went out, and I fell. Like something come alive, the rope lashed violently against my face, and I fell silently, endlessly into nothingness, as if dreaming of falling. I fell fast, faster than thought, and my stomach protested at the swooping speed of it. I swept down, and from far above I saw myself falling and felt nothing. No thoughts, and all fears gone away. So this is it. A whoomping impact on my back broke the dream, and the snow engulfed me. I felt cold wetness on my cheeks. I wasn't stopping, and for an instant, blinding moment, I was frightened. Now the crevasse. Oh, no! The acceleration took me again, mercifully fast, too fast for the scream which died above me. The whitest flashes burst in my eyes as a terrible impact whipped me into stillness. The flashes continued, bursting electric flashes in my eyes as I heard, but never felt, the air rush from my body. Snow followed down onto me, and I registered its soft blows from far away, hearing it scrape over me in a distant, disembodied way. Something in my head seemed to pulse and fade, and the flashes came less frequently. The shock had stunned me, so that for an immeasurable time I lay numb, hardly conscious of what had happened. As in dreams, time had slowed, and I seemed motionless in the air, unsupported, without mass. I lay still, with open mouth, open eyes, staring into blackness, thinking they were closed, and noting every sensation, all the pulsing messages in my body, and did nothing. I couldn't breathe. I retched. Nothing. Pressure pain in my chest, retching and gagging, trying hard for the air. Nothing. I felt a familiar dull roaring sound of shingles on a beach and relaxed. I shut my eyes and gave into grey fading shadows. My chest spasmed, then heaved out, and the roaring in my head suddenly cleared as cold air flowed in. I was alive. A burning, searing agony reached up from my leg. It was bent beneath me. As the burning increased, so the sense of living became fact. Heck, I couldn't be dead and feel that. It kept burning, and I laughed. Alive! Well, fuck me! And laughed again, a real happy laugh. I laughed through the burning, and kept laughing hard, feeling tears rolling down my face. I couldn't see what was so damn funny, but I laughed anyway, crying and laughing at high pitch as something uncurled within me, something tight and twisted in my guts that laughed itself apart and left me. I stopped laughing abruptly. My chest tightened, and the tension took hold again. What stopped me? I could see nothing. I lay on my side, crumpled strangely. I moved an arm cautiously in an arc. I touched a hard wall. Ice. It was the wall of the crevasse. I continued the search, and suddenly felt my arm drop into space. There was a drop close by me. I stifled the urge to move away from it. Behind me I felt my legs lying against a slope of snow. It also sloped steeply beneath me. I was on a ledge or a bridge. I wasn't slipping, but I didn't know which way to move to make myself safe. Face down in the snow, I tried to gather my confused ideas into a plan. What should I do now? Just keep still. That's it. Don't move. Ah! I couldn't stop myself. Pain in my knee jolted through me, demanding movement. I had to get my weight off it. I moved and slipped, every muscle gripped down at the snow. Don't move! The movement slowed, then stopped. I gasped, having held my breath for too long. Reaching out again, I felt my hand touch the hard ice wall. Then I groped for the ice hammer attached to a lanyard of thin cord clipped to my harness. Fumbling in the dark, I found the cord running tightly away from me and pulled it, bringing the hammer up out of the drop in front of me. I had to hammer an ice screw into the wall without pushing myself off the ledge I was perched on. It proved harder than I expected. Once I had found the last remaining screw attached to my harness, I had to twist round and face the wall. My eyes had adjusted to the darkness. Starlight and the moon glimmering through my entry hole in the roof above gave enough light for me to see the abysses on either side of me. I could see grey-shadowed ice walls and the stark blackness of the drops, too deep for the light to penetrate. As I began to hammer the screw into the ice, I tried to ignore the black space beyond my shoulder. The hammer blows echoed around the ice walls and from deep below me, from the depths of blackness at my shoulder. I heard second and third echoes drift up. I shuddered. The black space held untold horrors. I hit the screw and felt my body slide sideways with each blow. When it was driven into its hilt, I clipped a carabiner through the eye and hurriedly searched for the rope at my waist. The black spaces menaced, and my stomach knotted in empty squeezing clenches. I hauled myself into a half-sitting position close to the wall, facing the drop on my left. My legs kept slipping on the snow, so that I had constantly to shuffle back to the wall. I dared not let go of the ice screw for more than a few seconds, but my fingers needed a lot longer to tie the knot. I swore bitterly each time I made a mess of the knot and feverishly tried again. I couldn't see the rope, and although normally I could tie the knot blindfold, I was now hampered by frozen hands. I couldn't feel the rope well enough to thread it back on itself and form the knot. After 6 attempts, I was at the point of tears. I dropped the rope. Reaching for it, I slipped forward towards the drop and lunged back, scrabbling at the wall for the screw. My mitt slipped across the wall and I began to fall backwards. I clawed at the ice, trying to get my fingers to grip through the mitts, and then felt the screw hit my hand. My fingers locked round it and the fall stopped. I stayed motionless, staring at the black hole in front of me. After several abortive attempts, suddenly I found that I had tied a knot of sorts. I held it close to my face and looked up through it at the dim light shining through the entry hole in the roof above. I could see the bulge of the knot, and above it the loop I had been struggling to tie. I chuckled excitedly, feeling ridiculously pleased with myself, and clipped it to the ice screw, smiling foolishly into the darkness. I was safe from the black spaces. I relaxed against the comforting tightness of the rope and looked up at the small hole in the roof, where the sky was cloudless, packed with stars, and moonlight was adding its glow to their bright sparkle. The screwed-up tension in my stomach flowed away, and for the first time in many hours I began to order my mind into normal thoughts. I'm only, what, 50 feet down this crevasse? It's sheltered. I can get out in the morning, if I wait for Simon. Simon! I spoke his name aloud in a startled voice. The word echoed softly back. It hadn't occurred to me that he might be dead. And as I thought about what had happened, the enormity of it struck me. Dead. I couldn't conceive of him dead. Not now. Not after I've survived. The chill silence of the crevasse came over me. The feel of tombs. Of space for the lifeless, coldly impersonal. No one had ever been here. Simon dead. Can't be. I'd have heard him, seen him come over the cliff. He would have come onto the rope, or down here. I began to giggle again. Despite my efforts, I couldn't prevent it, and the echoes bounced back at me from the ice walls, sounding cracked and manic. It became so that I couldn't work out whether I was laughing or sobbing. The noises that returned from the darkness were distorted and inhuman, cackling echoes rolling up and around me. I giggled more, listened, and giggled again, and for a moment forgot Simon, and the crevasse, and even my leg. I sat hunched against the ice wall, laughing convulsively, and shivering. It was the cold. Part of me recognized this. A calm, rational voice in my head told me it was the cold and the shock. The rest of me went quietly mad while this calm voice told me what was happening and left me feeling as if I was split in two, one half laughing and the other looking on with unemotional objectivity. After a time, I realized that it all stopped, and I was whole again. I had shivered some warmth back, and the adrenaline from the fall had gone. I searched in my rucksack for the spare torch battery I knew was there. When I had fitted it, I switched on the beam and looked into the black space by my side. The bright new beam cut down through the blackness and lit ice walls that danced away down into depths my torch couldn't reach. The ice caught the light, so that it gleamed in blue, silver and green reflections, and I could see small rocks frozen into the surface dotted the walls at regular intervals. They glistened wetly as I swept the beam down the smooth scalloped dimples. I swallowed nervously. By the light I could see down into 100 feet of space. The walls, 20 feet apart, showed no sign of narrowing. I could only guess at how many hundreds of feet the blackness beyond my torch was hiding. In front of me, the opposite wall of the crevasse reared up in a tangle of broken ice blocks, and 50 feet above me they arched over to form a roof. The slope to my right fell away steeply for about 30 feet, after which it disappeared. Beyond it lay a drop into darkness. The darkness beyond the light gripped my attention. I could guess what it hid, and I was filled with dread. I felt trapped, and looked quickly around me for some break in the walls. There was none. Ice flashed light back from hard, blank walls, or else the beam was swallowed by the impenetrable blackness of the holes on either side. The roof covered the crevasse to my right and fell down in frozen chaos to my left, blocking the open end of the crevasse from my view. I was in a huge cavern of snow and ice. Only the small black hole above, winking starlights at me, gave any view of another world, and unless I climbed the blocks, it was as unreachable as the stars. I turned the torch off to save the batteries. The darkness seemed more oppressive than ever. Discovering what I had fallen into hadn't cleared my mind. I was alone. The silent emptiness and the dark and the star-filled hole above mocked my thoughts of escape. I could only think of Simon. He was the only chance of escape, but somehow I was convinced that if he was not dead, then he would think that I was. I shouted his name as loud as I could, and the sound jumped back at me, and then faded in dying echoes in the holes below me. The sound would never be heard through the walls of snow and ice. The roof was 50 feet above me. On the rope I had hung at least 50 feet above the roof. Simon would see the huge open side of the crevasse and the cliff, and he would know at once that I was dead. You can't fall that far and survive. That's what he would think. I knew it. I would think the same if I were in his place. He would see the endless black hole and know that I had died in it. The irony of falling 100 feet and surviving unscathed was almost unbearable. I swore bitterly, and the echoes from the darkness made it a futile gesture. I swore again and kept swearing, filling the chamber with angry obscenities which cursed me back in echoes. I screamed frustration and anger until my throat dried and I could shout no more. When I was silent, I tried to think of what would happen. If he looks in, he will see me. He might even hear me. Maybe he heard me just then. He won't leave unless he's sure. How do you know he's not dead already? Did he fall with me? Find out. Pull the rope. I tugged on the loose rope. It moved easily. When I turned my torch on, I noticed it hanging down from the hole in the roof. It hung in a slack curve. I pulled again, and soft snow flurried onto me. I pulled steadily, and as I did so, I became excited. This was a chance to escape. I waited for the rope to come tight. I wanted it to come tight. It kept moving easily. It was strange to want the weight of Simon's body to come onto the rope. I had instantly found a way to get out, and it meant only that. When Simon had fallen, he would have swept out and clear of the crevasse, so he must have hit the slope and stopped. He would be dead. He must be after that fall. When the rope comes tight, I can prussic up it. His body will anchor it solidly. Yes, that's it. I saw the rope flick down, and my hopes sank. I drew the slack rope to me and stared at the frayed end. Cut. I couldn't take my eyes from it. White and pink nylon filaments sprayed out from the end. I suppose I had known all along. It was a madness. Crazy to have believed in it. But everything was getting that way. I wasn't meant to get out of here. Damn it. I shouldn't even have got this far. He should have left me on the ridge. It would have saved so much. I'll die here after all that. Why bother trying? I turned off the torch and sobbed quietly in the dark, feeling overwhelmed. I cried in bursts, and between them listened to the childlike sounds fade beneath me, then cried again. It was cold when I awoke. I came up slowly from a long emptiness and wondered where I was. Sleep had taken me unawares, and I was startled. The cold had woken me. That was a good sign. It could as easily have taken me. I felt calm. It was going to end in the crevasse. Perhaps I had always known it would end this way. I felt pleased to be able to accept it calmly. All that sobbing and shouting had been too much. Acceptance seemed better. There was no trauma this way. I was certain then that Simon would leave me for dead. It didn't surprise me. Indeed, it made things easier. There was one less thing to worry about. I thought it might take me a few days to die. In the end, I decided that 3 days would pass. It was sheltered in the crevasse, and with my sleeping bag, I could survive a good few days. I imagined how long it would seem, a long, long period of twilight and darkness, drifting from exhausted sleep into half-consciousness. Maybe the last half would be dreamless sleeping, ebbing away quietly. I thought carefully of the end. It wasn't how I had ever imagined it. It seemed pretty sordid. I hadn't expected a blaze of glory when it came, nor had I thought it would be like this, slow, pathetic, fade into nothing. I didn't want it to be like that. I sat up and turned on the torch, looking at the wall above the ice screw. I thought it might be possible to climb out. Deep inside I knew it would be impossible, but I urged the faint hope on, deciding that if I fell, then at least it would be swift. My resolve failed me when I looked at the black void on either side of me. The ice bridge suddenly seemed to be desperately precarious. I fastened a prussic knot to the rope above the screw. I would climb while still attached to the screw. I could let slack rope out through the prussic, but if I fell, the prussic might stop me. I knew it would probably snap, but I couldn't summon enough nerve to climb unroped. An hour later, I gave up trying. I had made 4 attempts to climb the vertical ice wall. Only once had I managed to get myself clear of the ledge. I had planted both axes above me and hauled myself up. When I had kicked the crampons on my left boot into the wall, I reached up again with an axe. Before I could swing at the ice above, my crampon points broke free, and I slipped heavily onto my ice hammer. It ripped from the ice, and I felt back to the bridge, my injured leg folding agonizingly beneath me. I screamed and twisted to free it. Then I lay still, waiting for the pain to ease. I would not try again. I sat on my sack, turned off the torch, and slumped onto the rope which I had retied to the ice screw. I could see my legs in the gloom. There was a delay before I realized the significance of being able to see them. I glanced up to the patch of dim light in the roof and checked my watch. It was 5 o'clock. It would be fully light in an hour, and Simon would be coming down the cliff as soon as it was light. I had been alone in the dark for 7 hours, and until then I hadn't realized how demoralizing the lack of light had been. I shouted Simon's name loudly. It echoed round me, and I shouted again. I would shout regularly until he heard me, or until I was certain he had gone. A long time later, I stopped shouting. He had gone. I knew he would, and I knew he wouldn't return. I was dead. There would be nothing for him to come back for. I took my mitts and inner gloves off and examined my fingers. 2 blackened fingers on each hand and 1 bluish thumb. I curled them into fists and tried to squeeze hard, but couldn't feel the pressure. It wasn't as bad as I had thought. Sunlight streamed through the hole in the roof. I glanced at the hole to my left. I could see deeper into it, but there was no sign of it closing up. It just faded into dark shadows a long way down. To my right, the slope angled away to the drop I had seen the previous night. Far away to the right of this, sunlight sprayed against the back wall of the crevasse. I picked absently at the frayed end of the rope, trying to come to a decision. I already knew that I wasn't prepared to spend another night on the ledge. I wasn't going through that madness again, but I cringed from doing the only thing left to me. I wasn't ready for such a choice. Without deciding, I took some coils in hand, and then threw the rope down to the right. It flew clean out into space, and curled over the drop before falling out of sight. The rope jerked tight. I clipped my figure of 8 to the rope and lay on my side. I hesitated, looking at the ice screw buried in the wall. It wouldn't pull free under my weight. The prussic knot hung unused just below the ice screw. I thought that I should take it with me. If there was empty space at the end of the rope, I would be unable to regain the ledge without it. I let myself slide off the ledge and watched the prussic getting smaller as I abseiled down the slope to the drop. If there was nothing there, I didn't want to come back.
8. Silent Witness. As I descended, the sense of menace threatened to overwhelm me. In contrast to the fury of the night before, it was unnervingly quiet. I expected an avalanche to come hissing down, but nothing moved. There wasn't a breath of wind to flurry the powder on the face, and even the snow kicked down by my steps slid away silently. It was as if the mountains were holding their breath, waiting for another death. Joe had died. The silence said so. But must they take me as well? It was warm in the sun. The face caught its glare in the huge white bowl above me. And up there, thousands of feet above me, the snow shimmered in the heat. We had been up there yesterday, but there was no trace of our passing. The night had swept it clean, and it waved gently in the heat haze. There was a dry, foul taste in my mouth, dehydration, no doubt, or a hollow bitterness rising. I stared at the mountain rising over me, empty. It was a pointless thing to have done, climb up it, across it, and down it, stupid. It looked perfect, so clean and untouched, and we had changed nothing. It was beautiful, immaculate. But it left me empty. I had been on it too long, and it had taken everything. I continued the descent, stepping down with methodical precision. I could have moved quicker, but somehow there didn't seem to be any point. The windless silence closed over me. The glacier below my feet, encircled by ice mountains, remained quiet. There were no muffled ice collapses or crevasses creaking open. I carried on down, oppressed by the unnatural calm, and sensing that the hushed aura waited on me. I would let it wait. I wanted to do this thing with calm and dignity. The sense of menace grew heavier as I carefully retreated. Crusts of snow slithered quickly over a drop below me. I was standing on the edge of an ice cliff. I leaned out from the slope and peered over the cliff at least 100 feet down. I raised my eyes and searched the glacier directly beneath the cliff for signs of life. There was nothing. No telltale signs of a snow hole. So this is what he went over. My God! Why this? Here? We never knew. The dreadful suspicion that I had nursed through the night was confirmed. Joe was dead. I stared at the glacier below in shocked silence. Although I had feared the worst, I had never expected to find this. I had envisaged a small vertical wall, a rock buttress even, but not this towering ice cliff. I looked back up the face and marked the descent we had taken during the lowerings, in a plumb straight line down to where I stood. I felt cheated. The very means by which we had managed to rescue ourselves had caused the accident. I remember the mounting excitement I had felt as we had progressed smoothly down the mountain. I had been proud of what we had managed. It had worked so well. And all Joe's pain, all his digging and fighting, had simply speeded the inevitable accident on the cliff. Over to the side, I could make out the descent we had originally intended to take, descending diagonally to the left, away from the cliff. When we had decided on that line, we hadn't noticed the ice cliff on the right. We had never imagined we would be lowering straight down. I turned away from the drop and glared sightlessly at the peak directly in front of me. The cruelty of it all sickened me. It felt as if there was something deliberate about it, something preordained by a bored and evil force. The whole day's effort and the chaos in the stormy night had been for nothing. What fools we were to have thought we had been clever enough to get away with it. All that time struggling just to cut the rope. I laughed. The short, bitter noise rang loud in the quiet. It was funny, I supposed. In a sick sort of way, it was funny, all right, but the joke was on me. Some joke. Faced into the snow slope, I began traversing the lip of the cliff. My fatalism had gone. Anger replaced it, and resentment, and with this bitter fury, my lethargy disappeared. The resignation had been swept away. Although I felt weak and drained, I was determined now to get off the mountain alive. It wasn't taking me as well. Every now and then I glanced over the edge of the cliff. The further right I moved, the shallower the cliff became. But the ground I was climbing over became increasingly steep and dangerous. Eventually, the cliff face merged into the slope I was crossing, and the soft snow gave way to hard water ice, with the occasional shattered rock protruding from it. I began to make a diagonal descent, moving very slowly. The climbing was technically demanding, so I found myself concentrating totally on what I was doing, and the emotions of earlier were forgotten. After descending 50 feet, I came to a rock frozen into the ice. I stood on the points of my crampons on 70-degree ice, which was becoming harder and more brittle with every foot I descended. On closer inspection, I saw that I was on part of a rock buttress bulging out from under the ice. Glancing down, I saw that the ice rapidly thinned, and greyish shadows told me that the rock was only inches from the surface. I hammered a piton into a crack in the rock and clipped myself to it. I found it awkward setting up the abseil. The rope was still frozen from the storm, and my numb fingers seemed to refuse to tie the knot for me. When it was done, I threw the rope clear, and it hung from the piton, dropping over the steep ground and reaching the easy slopes 150 feet below me. I fixed my belay plate to the rope, unclipped myself from the piton, and abseiled slowly down the ice-covered buttress. As I moved down the rope, the ice cliff gradually revealed itself. It stretched away to my left in a huge dome-shaped wall. At the top of the dome, I saw where our ropes had cut deeply into the edge the previous night. They marked the highest point of the cliff. The face of the cliff was overhanging. The wall of white snow ice loomed out from the mountain, and the further I abseiled, the more impending it became, until it seemed to hang over me, despite the fact that I was well over to the right of it. I stared at it in amazement. It was huge, and I couldn't help but wonder why we had never noticed it. When we had approached the mountain, we had walked across the glacier directly beneath it. It wasn't until I had descended half the rope's length that I glanced down and saw the crevasse. I jammed the belay plate shut and stopped abruptly. I stared at the endless black depths at the foot of the cliff and shuddered in horror. Joe had undoubtedly fallen into the crevasse. I was appalled. The idea of falling into that monstrous blackness yawning below me made me grip the rope tightly. I shut my eyes and pressed my forehead against the taut rope. For a long, nauseous moment, feelings of guilt and horror flooded through me. It was as if I had only just that minute cut the rope. I might as well have put a gun to his head and shot him. When I opened my eyes, I couldn't look down at the crevasse, and stared hopelessly at the rock-shadowed ice in front of me instead. Now that I was virtually clear of the mountain and assured of my own survival, the full impact of what we had been through struck me. In the warm and peaceful sun, the events of the previous night seemed so distant that I couldn't believe they had been so terrible. Everything had changed so much. I almost wished it was still as bad. At least then I would be fighting something. I would have reasons to justify my survival and his end. As it was, I had only the stark blackness of the crevasse to accuse me. I had never felt so wretchedly alone. I could not have won, and began to understand the reason for my dreadful sense of condemnation in the snow cave. If I hadn't cut the rope, I would certainly have died. Looking at the cliff, I knew there would have been no surviving such a fall. Yet, having saved myself, I was now going to return home and tell people a story that few would ever believe. No one cuts the rope. It could never have been that bad. Why didn't you do this or try that? I could hear the questions and see the doubts in the eyes even of those who accepted my story. It was bizarre, and it was cruel. I had been onto a loser from the moment he broke his leg, and nothing could have changed it. I tried to break from these useless thoughts by abseiling lower, staring into the crevasse, trying to see, desperately wanted to see, some sign of life. As I moved closer, it grew wider, and the depths gained perspective and loomed deeper. I kept staring in, but my brief hopes faded with every foot descended. No one could have survived a fall into such depths. And even if Joe had, there was nothing I could do for him. There was not enough rope here, or at camp, to reach down so deep. I knew also that I had no strength for such a task. It would be a vain and hopeless act to go down into the crevasse, and I was no longer prepared to face such risks. I had had enough of dying. "Joe!" I shouted, but the sound echoed in the blackness, mocking my puny effort. It was too big, and the truth too stark. I couldn't try to believe he was alive. Everything told me otherwise, and any efforts I made to the contrary were just so much conscience-salving. I had looked into that awful hole and shouted into it. In return, I heard an echo and then an absolute silence that said everything I already knew. My feet touched the snow. The abseil was over, and below me a slope ran smoothly down to the glacier. Another 200 feet would see me safely on it. I turned and looked up the ice cliff. I was at its extreme right hand, and slightly below the outer lip of the crevasse. The rope marks were still visible at the top of the cliff, mute testament to what I had done. Some fine powder snow fell from the cliff top in a gauzy white cloud. I watched it drift softly down. This place was ageless and lifeless, a mass of snow and ice and rock slowly moving upwards, freezing, thawing, cracking asunder, always changing with the passing of centuries. What a silly thing to pit oneself against. The snow cloud settled on the roofed area of the crevasse further to my left. Joe had fallen through there. At least it had hidden his body from me, though I doubted I would have been able to see so far down. I turned away, suppressing the idea of going back up for a second look. There was no point. There had to come a time for facing the truth. I couldn't stand there all day searching for a corpse. I faced the glacier and heeled down towards it, feeling dazed. When I reached the level snow of the glacier, I dropped my sack in the snow and sat down. For a long time I stared bleakly at my boots, not wanting to look back at the mountain. The sense of security was overwhelming. I had made it. I just sat there thinking about the mountain and all the days we had spent on it. I felt as if I were reviewing a year of my life, not 6 days. The glacier, walled in by ice faces, was a furnace of sun. Painfully white, it absorbed the heat from all sides and seemed to focus it onto me. I had taken off my jacket, over trousers and thermal top without thinking. My actions had become automatic. The climbing and abseiling had happened without deliberate decision on my part. It was as if I had suddenly been transplanted to the glacier without any conscious effort, and my memory of the day's events had already faded into a blur of emotions and shocked thoughts. It was then that I realized how desperately tired I had become. The lack of food and water in the last 24 hours had taken its toll. Looking back at the ice cliff, which now seemed one small feature on a vast face, I knew I would never be able to get back up there. I wondered whether I would even manage to get to base camp. It would take days to eat, rest, and recover enough to mount a rescue attempt. Perhaps it's for the best then, Joe. At least you're dead. I almost spoke aloud to the distant ice cliff. The thought of finding him alive and terribly injured horrified me. I would have had to leave him to fetch help, but there was no help. When I was strong enough to return, he would have died some desperate, lonely death in the ice. "Yes, it's best this way," I whispered. I trudged through the softened snow on the glacier, keeping my back to Sula Grande. I could feel its presence massed behind me, and yearned to turn and look at it again. I kept walking, head down, staring fixedly at the snow until I reached the crevasses at the end of the glacier. The ice had twisted and fractured in hundreds of parallel crevasses as the glacier ground up against the rock moraines. Some crevasses were easily seen and avoided, but many were covered with snow. Rolling smooth slopes hid the dangers below, and without a rope, I felt naked and vulnerable. The early morning paranoia returned with a vengeance. In a foggy daze of heat and thirst, I had forgotten the line we had taken when we approached the mountain. The first feelings of panic built up as I stared wildly from one crevasse to another. Had we gone above or below that one? Or was it that lower one? I couldn't remember. The harder I tried, the more confused I became, and eventually I was weaving a contorted and terrifying path, unsure of where I was heading. Only the few feet of surrounding snow concerned me, and I moved aimlessly across the slopes, zigzagging, sometimes backtracking, and at any moment I expected the snow to open a black emptiness beneath my feet. When I reached the moraines, I slumped down against a rock with my sack as a pillow, feeling the hot sun on my face as the fear of the crevasses melted away. Raging thirst eventually forced me to my feet, and I stumbled unsteadily towards the widening boulder-strewn river which ran down from the moraines to the lakes above our camp. It was about 4.5 miles to base, say a couple of hours walking. I knew I could find water halfway down where melting snow streamed over a huge, rounded granite boulder, and that was all I wanted. I could smell the water all around me. It trickled between boulders at my feet, and deeper in the crevices below the boulders I could hear it gurgling in full flow, yet unreachable. After a few yards I stopped and turned for a last look at Sula Grande. I could see most of it, but was thankful that the lower reaches were hidden by the curve of the glacier. I couldn't see the ice cliff. He was up there, buried in the snow, but I no longer felt guilty about it. If I were ever in the same position again, I felt certain I would act in the same way. Instead, there was a slow ache inside, a growing sense of loss and sorrow. This is what it had all come down to, standing alone amid the mountain debris, thinking of the waste and the pity. I thought of saying a quiet farewell as I turned to leave, but in the end didn't. He had gone for good. The steady surge of the glacier would take him down to the valleys in the coming years, but by then he would have become a casual memory. Already, it seemed, I was beginning to forget him. I stumbled through the chaotic maze of boulders and scree. When at last I looked back at the glacier, Sula Grande was no longer visible. I sagged wearily against a boulder, letting my mind run haphazardly over my pain and sorrow. The thirst had become unbearable. My mouth was dry and I swallowed. What little saliva it produced failed to ease the discomfort. The descent had become a confused blur of endless boulder fields, burning midday sun, and the thirst. My legs felt weighted down and so weakened I fell repeatedly among the rocks. When loose rocks slipped suddenly under my feet, I found that I had no strength to prevent myself falling. I used the axe to steady myself and occasionally flung a hand out for support. Fingers slapped unfeeling against sharp boulders. The sun had failed to revive any sensation in them, and they remained numb and cold. After an hour, I saw the rounded boulder, with water glistening as it ran over its flank. I quickened my pace, feeling a burst of energy come through me at the thought of water. When I reached the hollow at the base of the boulder, and dropped my rucksack on the wet scree, I saw that there was not enough flow to satisfy my craving thirst. Carefully, I built a catchment area in the gravel at the base of the rock. It filled with tantalizing slowness, and after sucking a gritty mouthful was empty again. I crouched at the rock, drinking and waiting, and drinking again. There seemed no end to the amount I could drink. A sudden clatter from above made me duck away to the side. A handful of rocks thumped into the scree beside me. I hesitated before returning to the water pool. We had rested and drunk from here on the way up. Rocks had also fallen on us then, and we had jumped away laughing at our fright. Joe had called it Bomb Alley. The melting snow above the boulder released regular bombardments of small rocks as the day heated up. I sat on my sack, spitting bits of grit from my mouth. There were footprints in the soft, muddy scree and gravel of the hollow, the only trace left of our attempt on the mountain. It was a lonely place to rest. In the huge chaos of the moraines, I had sat down to rest at the one spot where I would be reminded. We had sat in the same spot 6 days earlier. All our keen excitement and the healthy, strong feel in our bodies had become an empty memory. I glanced at the moraines which hid the lower lake. There was little time left for this loneliness. I would reach base camp in another hour, and then it would be finished. I set off for the lakes, the water flooding a fresh strength into my limbs. I was worried now by the thought of meeting Richard, who would want to know what had happened. Everyone would want to know. I didn't want to face the prospect of telling him. If I told him the truth, I would be forced to tell the same story when I returned to home. All I could think about was the disbelief and criticism I was inevitably going to be confronted with. I couldn't face it. I shouldn't have to face it. Anger and guilt clashed in my arguments as to what I should do. I knew above everything that I had been right to do what I had done. Deep inside, I would always know that I had nothing to be ashamed of. If I concealed the truth, it wouldn't be so bad. I would be avoiding a lot of unnecessary pain and anguish. Why tell them that you cut the rope? They'll never know otherwise, so what difference does it make? Just say he fell down a crevasse when we were coming down the glacier. Yeah, tell them we were unroped. I know it's a stupid thing to do, but damn it, lots of climbers die like that. He's dead. How he died isn't important. I didn't kill. It's lucky I'm here at all, so why make it worse? I can't tell the truth. God, I hardly believe it myself. They certainly won't. When I reached the lake, I was still convincing myself that to tell the truth was stupid. I knew it would only cause me grief. I could scarcely bear to think what Joe's parents would say. After drinking again at the lake, I walked on towards camp more slowly. My mind kept telling me what I should say. It was reasonable and sensible. I couldn't fault the logic. But something inside shied away from doing it. Perhaps it was guilt. However many times I persuaded myself that I had no choice but to cut the rope, a nagging thought said otherwise. It seemed like a blasphemy to have done such a thing. It went against every instinct, even against self-preservation. The time passed without notice. I had wrapped myself in tangled, hurtful thoughts until I felt I must surely burst. I could listen to no rational arguments against the feelings of guilt and cowardice which insisted so painfully. With the same fatalism as before, I resigned myself to punishment. It seemed right to be punished, to atone for leaving him dead as if simply surviving had been a crime in itself. My friends would believe me and understand. The others could choose to think what they wished, and if it hurt me, well, perhaps I deserved it. At the end of the second small lake, I climbed the final rise of the moraines and looked down on the two tents at base camp. The thought of food and drink and medication for my frostbite made me hurry down the cactus-covered hillside above the tents. I had forgotten about the dilemma of what to say to Richard and was almost running in my haste to get down. I slowed down to scramble over a small hillock, from the top of which I saw Richard walking slowly towards me. He was carrying a small rucksack and was bent over looking at the ground. He hadn't heard me. I stood still, shocked by his sudden appearance, and waited for him to come to me. An awful weariness rushed through me as I waited silently. It was all over, and the relief flooding me deepened the sense of exhaustion. I felt as if I were going to cry, but my eyes remained stubbornly dry. Richard looked up from the path and saw me. His anxious expression changed to surprise, and then he grinned broadly, his eyes alight with pleasure as he hurried to me. "Simon, it's good to see you. I was worried." I could think of nothing to say, and stared blankly at him. He looked confused and searched behind me for some sign of Joe. Perhaps my face told him, or he had been expecting something bad. "Joe?" "Joe's dead."
"Dead?"
I nodded. We fell silent. We couldn't look at each other. I dropped my sack to the ground and sat heavily on it, feeling as if I would never be able to stand up again.
"You look terrible."
I didn't reply. I was thinking about what to say to him. My plan to lie was all very well, but I couldn't summon enough energy to tell it. I stared at my blackened fingers helplessly.
"Here, eat this."
He handed me a bar of chocolate.
"I've got a stove. I'll get some tea going. I was just coming up to look for you. I thought you were lying hurt somewhere. Did Joe fall? What's happened?"
"Yeah. He fell," I said flatly. "There was nothing I could do." He chattered on nervously. I think he sensed that I needed time to adjust. I watched him preparing the tea, passing me more food, and searching in the medicine bag he had brought up. Eventually, he gave it to me, and I took it without saying anything. I felt a sudden deep affection and gratitude to him for being there. I knew he would have killed himself in the crevasses on the glacier if he had managed to get that far. I wondered whether he had been aware of the danger. He glanced up and saw me watching him. We smiled at each other. It was warm sitting on the hillock. Without realizing I was doing it, I told Richard exactly what had happened. I could have done nothing else. He sat silently listening to all that I had been through, not once questioning me, nor looking surprised at what I was saying to him. I was glad I was telling him the truth. Not to have done so might have saved me hurt, but I knew as I told him that there was so much more we had managed to do that should be told. The rescue in the storm, the way we had worked together, the way we fought to get down alive. I couldn't say Joe had fallen into a crevasse when stupidly walking unroped on the glacier, not after he had been through so much trying to survive. I couldn't do him the injustice of lying. And my feeling of having failed him made it an impossibility to lie. When I'd finished, Richard looked at me. I knew something terrible had happened. I'm just glad you managed to get down. We packed away the remains of his provisions, and he put them in my big sack and then shouldered both sacks. We walked quietly down to the tents. For me, the rest of the day passed in a sluggish haze. I lay wearily in the sun outside the dome tent, with my gear scattered around me, drying in the sun. We talked no more of Joe. Richard busied himself producing a hot meal and endless cups of tea. Then he sat near me and talked of the long wait he had endured, gradually accepting that some disaster had overtaken us, until he could bear the uncertainty no longer and had set out to find us. For 6 or 7 hours I did nothing but doze and eat in the sun. It was difficult to adjust to the luxury of camp. I could feel my strength returning, and lay in half-sleep, feeling my body mending itself. Towards early evening the clouds massed in from the east, and the first heavy raindrops spattered us. There was a heavy roll of thunder, and we retreated to the big domed tent, which up until then I had been reluctant to enter. Richard brought his sleeping bag over from his tent and began cooking another meal on 2 gas stoves in the entrance. By the time we had finished eating, the rain had turned to snow, and a strong wind was shaking the tent. It was freezing outside. We lay side by side in our sleeping bags, listening to the storm. The candlelight flickered red and green off the tent walls, and by it I saw Joe's possessions shoved untidily to the back of the tent. I thought of the storm the previous night and shuddered. The picture remained in my head as I fell asleep. I knew how bad it would be up there. The avalanches would be pouring down, filling the crevasse at the ice cliff, burying him. I fell into an exhausted, dreamless sleep.
9. In the far distance. The snow made soft rustling noises as it slithered into the depths below. I stared at the ice screw far above me, watching it getting smaller. The ice bridge, which had stopped my fall, stood out clearly. Behind it, the open cavern of the crevasse faded into shadows. I gripped the rope gently and let it slide through the belay plate at a smooth, constant rate. The desire to stop abseiling was almost unbearable. I had no idea what lay below me, and I was certain only of 2 things. Simon had gone, and would not return. This meant that to stay on the ice bridge would finish me. There was no escape upwards, and the drop on the other side was nothing more than an invitation to end it all quickly. I had been tempted, but even in my despair, I found that I didn't have the courage for suicide. It would be a long time before cold and exhaustion overtook me on the ice bridge, and the idea of waiting alone and maddened for so long had forced me to this choice: abseil until I could find a way out, or die in the process. I would meet it, rather than wait for it to come to me. There was no going back now, yet inside I was screaming to stop.